This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Laurie Allen. She's the Assistant Director for Digital Scholarship at the University of Pennsylvania, and she is a 2018 Library Journal Mover and Shaker. Circulating Ideas is brought to you with support from Unique Management Services and from listeners like you. Unique Management Services is the worldwide leader in material recovery for libraries with a proven track record of professional and effective communication with library patrons. Unique also offers inbound phone and live chat coverage for public libraries. Are incoming phone calls creating an operational and customer service challenge for your library? Are the communication options on your website inconvenient for online patrons and limited to library hours? Unique solves these problems with phone and chat coverage that make virtual service a snap for patrons. From renewing items to downloading ebooks to reserving meeting rooms, Unique offers flexible service formats to keep patrons engaged and active and give library staff more time for in-house patron and key job tasks. Unique Patron Service Solutions, virtual service solved. Visit uniquelibrary.com to learn more and schedule your free demo. That's uniquelibrary.com. Laurie, welcome to Circulating Ideas.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I like to start the show a lot of times with just finding out how you became a librarian in the first place. What drew you to the field?
Wow, it was a long time ago, and there are so many things. Right after college, I worked in the publishing industry as a temp for a year, and I loved being around information and scholarship, and I did not like the publishing industry. And I guess that same year, all of my wish list items were reference books. So someone told me I should be a librarian, and it felt exactly right. And then it occurred to me that I had worked in libraries all through college, and maybe that was a sign.
So it was a good thing.
Yes.
And what did you always kind of know that you wanted to be in academic libraries?
No, not at all. I thought when I went to library school, I had read a book called The Goldbug Variations by Richard Powers, which features a librarian working at the Brooklyn Public Library who just seemed really cool. And I very much thought that I would be like a cataloging librarian at a public library. I thought the idea of being part of the sort of formal organization of community knowledge would be really exciting. And I wanted to be sort of, yeah, in public libraries. But pretty early in library school, I gravitated more towards reference in academic libraries.
Right. And then this year, you were, and we're going to talk about some of the things that they nominated you for, but you were nominated and you won a Library Journal Mover and Shaker Award. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Did that come as a surprise to you?
Yes. I mean, definitely.
No, I'm awesome. And I
exactly. I'm expecting it. No, it was a big surprise. I think it felt really, I was really honored, and it felt like a big privilege, but also it was a little uncomfortable in that it really called out my work on Data Refuge, which I'm very proud of, but which was absolutely collaborative. And so the notion of a kind of individual recognition for what felt and really was deeply, deeply, deeply collaborative work was a little bit strange, but you know, an awesome honor. I'm not going to turn it down. It was wonderful.
Well, thank you for saving the government by yourself, Laurie.
Yeah, exactly. Like, no.
Well, that's a lot of what we're going to talk about today is the Data Refuge Project. But before we get to that, can you talk in much broader terms of what digital scholarship is? That's what your job title is there at Penn.
There's so much to say about what digital scholarship is. The easiest description that I usually draw on is that in my department, we work to expand the capacity for faculty, students, and librarians to create scholarship in new forms. And by new forms, I mean both new technical forms, so right, things that are not books and articles, but are expressions of scholarship that might take different forms. That's one version, but also more publicly facing scholarship. So a new form of scholarship might be something like a data set, as a simple example, or it might be an exhibition that is in public, that involves technology and person-to-person contact. And so thinking more broadly about the kinds of scholarship that's expressed today and how much of it is digital and how libraries can support both the creation and the kind of long life of these new forms of scholarship. So that's a really broad definition, and but that's generally what I say.
Okay.
And there's a more cynical definition, which I actually like to give alongside that one.
Okay.
Which is that it's not really more cynical, it's more practical, which is that library organizations, libraries organizationally, especially large research libraries, but really all academic libraries, are really set up to efficiently process book and article type scholarship, so that we know how to get it, how to save it, how to store it, how to describe it, how to make it accessible, how to help people find it. For the increasing range of scholarly expression that are not books and articles, often academic libraries don't quite know how to approach them at all. And so a digital scholarship department is often where we end up putting all the people who are working on pieces of the kind of scholarly landscape of publishing or scholarly communication or even production, scholarly production, that we don't really know what to do with. So we don't have workflows that work yet for these new kinds of things. And so we make a digital scholarship department and ask that group of people to try to figure it out. And it's fun work.
Yeah, well, yeah, and you're forging new ground here. So, I did like the I don't remember where I read it, the analogy that you used about kind of rivers and making new pathways and finding watching which way the water goes and things like that. So,
yes, that is a really helpful metaphor for me to not feel like we're either drowning or just at sea.
Just finding new pathways.
Yeah, carving new channels and trying to see what we can float down those channels.
Do you generally work with faculty more on that kind of thing, or more with students, or a combination?
Certainly, I think it has to be a combination. I think students, often especially undergraduate students, are, I think, really uniquely good at helping to translate between disciplines in academia and between kind of more academic or scholarly ways of knowing and communicating and ways that are sort of more generally applicable or often digitally comfortable. So, mm-hmm. So undergraduates, I think we can't do this work without partnering with them because they're just so good at thinking about how a kind of critical question asked within a discipline might make sense or might be deepened or broadened by using a kind of public technology approach. Not because they're perfect at technology, just because they are practiced at working across sort of, they're learning, they're constantly learning. And so they're good at that kind of thing. So I think working with undergraduates as partners in thinking about how new kinds of scholarship might emerge is really valuable. But practically, a lot of the work that we do in digital scholarship is based around a kind of faculty interest in a new kind of project. So yeah, mostly we work with faculty, but we partner a lot with undergraduates in trying to think creatively about how to approach those partnerships.
Yeah, well, I think the undergrads can kind of do what you were talking about, is where people who are kind of in deep with all this stuff, it's hard to break out and think of new ways to think about it. But you have somebody new coming in who's not been publishing for 30, 40 years. All of a sudden they're like, oh, well, why don't you do this? And like, oh, I never even thought of that before.
Exactly. Absolutely. Exactly. I mean, I think taking seriously those questions, why is this so hard to understand? Okay, there's really good reasons why it's hard to understand, which we want to help you understand things that are hard to understand. But also great question. Let's think about that.
Right. Well, and sometimes it may be, oh, you're right, that shouldn't be that difficult. And you've just made a new little channel or something here now.
Right. Exactly. So, yeah. So, but like, you know, most of the projects we do, if we're going to put a lot of time and energy into building a new channel, we want to make sure that, that the kind of institutional, that the people who know disciplinary questions and that sort of thing, which is the faculty, are engaged and kind of want to move in that direction. So we certainly work with them quite a lot.
This is me showing my ignorance. Is digital scholarship, is that a big thing throughout a lot of universities now? Are a lot of universities going to this?
So there, I just actually came from a meeting recently of heads of digital scholarship departments in a small consortium called the Ivies Plus, which is a really, it's just sort of embarrassing to even talk about. It's the Ivies, the eight Ivy League institutions plus Johns Hopkins, Duke, MIT, University of Chicago, and Stanford. So that's the group. And okay. Almost all of those institutions now have a department called digital scholarship, which was fascinating. It was the first time we'd gotten together. Almost all of them are new. My department at Penn is only 2 years old. Before I was at Penn, I was at Haverford College, where I was the first digital scholarship person there. I would say more and more and more there are digital scholarship departments in libraries. And again, I think it is because there's a growing recognition that the kind of traditional structures in libraries aren't perfectly reflecting the kinds of scholarship that people are producing. And so digital scholarship departments are a kind of space for experimentation that is increasingly in need, even though what those departments look like is actually really different across these institutions.
Before we get into the Data Refuge project, I did want to ask about one thing that you had on your site, talking about the Philadelphia Neighborhoods Map Project. I think maps are really cool, so I thought that was interesting. Can you talk about what that project was and what your interest was in sort of wanting to update it someday?
So from 1945 to 1990, I can't remember what the number is, but something like 70 publications were put out by the City Planning Commission for the City of Philadelphia. And they were basically these neighborhood studies, right? 1945 to 1990 includes urban renewal and all sorts of giant changes to the land, to the really structure of the City of Philadelphia, you know, new highways, the destruction of neighborhoods and construction of different neighborhoods throughout the city and what gets reported on as white flight, but is also just large scale disinvestment or changes in investment in city structure. So anyway, that was all happening from 1945 to 1990. The city planning reports were digitized by the Penn Libraries like in the 90s and they were each report is, you know, somewhere between 20 pages, maybe 15 pages, and like sometimes they're like 90 pages. And they include maps and descriptions of communities, of really sometimes like block by block descriptions of various parts of Philadelphia. And these descriptions were all made with an eye to changing the landscape, reshaping the city. They're from the City Planning Commission. So anyway, I love those documents because I think they tell a really fascinating story about the city. The way that the Penn Libraries digitized them was using a platform which was created basically to host medieval manuscripts. And it is great at hosting medieval manuscripts where often you want to get a really, really, really deep close-up of what the page looks like. Mm-hmm. But not, they're terrible for hosting what we all want to see is basically like, please let me download the PDF. There's no way to do that from this site. There's no way to download the PDF. The page turning is super confusing. It's a terrible platform. And so when I knew I was coming back to the Penn Libraries after having been gone for 8 years, I just got really excited about the idea of making those valuable documents available as the kind of data that will make them useful for instance, people who are currently working with data about Philadelphia and might want to see the boundaries of neighborhoods that used to exist and that sort of thing. Right. And so transforming these documents, which are, they're kind of digital almost in name only. They're just, it's like pictures of what should be digital data,
right.
Instead of actually making it digital. Even though you can see it on a computer, you can't use it in the way that you that computers want to use things. And so it's just been a long time interest of mine to rework those documents and make them more valuable as data. But it's not actually something we did a first step in it, which I'm very happy about, but it's still like out there as a thing that I keep wanting to play with.
It's a back burner project.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the Data Refuge Project. Can you talk about generally what the project is in general?
Sure. The project started in response to the 2016 national election and was an effort to safeguard environmental and climate data that was produced by published by the federal government or held on federal websites. It was led by a huge group of people, but largely the Program in Environmental Humanities with whom the library collaborated in support of this project. And the Program in Environmental Humanities has kept Data Refuge going into the present with a stories project that we are supporting, but that's, the sort of next phase. The phase that I was mostly involved in was the effort to safeguard data in both sort of technical and social ways.
So how did you get involved with the project? Did they come to you?
So I had been collaborating with Bethany Wiggin, who's the director for the Program in Environmental Humanities, and her collaborators on another project that was about a part of the Lower Schuylkill River in Philadelphia, where there just isn't enough data. It's the site of the largest oil refineries on the Eastern Seaboard, and it's inside the city of Philadelphia. And while the public water is actually public, sort of like our public data is public, it's very hard to access. It's very hard to get to the water. And so I had already been working with them on thinking about what a kind of living archive of that river might be, how we could gather and present data about this unknown place so that neighbors could use it and so that communities could understand it. So we already had a relationship. And when the graduate students, after the election, became concerned about risks to federal environmental and climate data, they came to me and my colleague Margaret Jans in the library to help understand the problem and think about ways to address it.
And some of this data had been captured by the Internet Archive at the end of their end of term project. Is that what it's called?
End of term? The end of term harvest had been, which is a collaboration between University of North Texas and Stanford and the Internet Archive and other academic libraries. That had been going on. This was its third transition. So this has been going on for like 12 years and was in need of support. And so a big part of what Data Refuge did was collaborate with others to add to that effort, because the federal website, the sort of hugeness of federal websites at a moment of transition is so much that they really did need volunteers to help.
Right.
So a big part of Data Refuge was just helping that project, was adding, you know, a huge amount of sort of labor and volunteer effort to that.
Yeah, and it seems like in the past it was always kind of, well, here's a backup of things, not so much we expect this to be deleted soon, which was sort of what the expectation was in 2016. That a lot of this is like in danger of actively not just being lost due to some failure or something, but being actively removed from government websites, which I believe it then was.
I think a big part of the Data Refuge work was actually trying to both understand for ourselves and also help everyone or as many people as we could gain a broader understanding of exactly what are the risks, right? Because data has disappeared from information has disappeared from government websites and actually from all websites for in ways that probably should be making all of us uncomfortable mm-hmm. for years. Like every change in administration, the government takes some stuff down and puts other stuff up. And honestly, every time federal agencies and programs change what they do, they just change it on the website. And often, depending on which laws are enforced and which laws exist and what they're doing, often those changes just aren't marked. And so there's some risk that wasn't the fault of the Trump administration. But given that this administration was so anti-science, especially what happened in Canada with Stephen Harper, there was real concern that in addition to the kind of natural and very problematic loss of information that happens during every government transition, which we also like needed to be paying much closer attention to for years anyway, and which is what the end of term harvest was doing. In addition to that, there was this fear that scientific data that and environmental and human data, just information that we all count on for the kind of running of our society and for science, was going to be, was going to be erased. And in some case that erasure might come from taking down information from websites, but other ways of getting rid of it is to stop collecting it altogether, to defund the programs that use it. And so calling attention to all of the ways that the federal government supports the sort of information landscape that we rely on, especially for science, but really for all, for the rest of society, was a big part of this project.
And so you all held a codeathon to help focus it all kind of at one time. Can you talk about the codeathon?
Sure. So at Penn, we called it a data rescue. That we had wanted to make sure ours was before the inauguration. So it was in January of 2017. We gathered a couple hundred people together in Philadelphia. There had already been an event hosted at the University of Toronto that they had organized, and we had sent a couple, Bethany sent a few people from PPEH, graduate students, Patricia Kim and others up to Toronto. And then at Penn, we really, really focused on getting the workflow together so that we could get some of the data that can't be saved by the Internet Archive. The stuff that just can't be, it's not a website that the Internet Archive can get. And so we focused at our event on bringing a huge range of people with a lot of different skills, including technology people, people who were hackers, but also photographers and storytellers and scientists who could help us understand what the data was useful for, all sorts of people together at Penn and coming up with a workflow that would help us safeguard data that can't be saved. And we made the workflow and then a lot of people, lots of librarians, lots of technologists, most, you know, and archivists made this workflow, documented it, and then shared it. And after ours, there were about 50 data rescue events that used the workflows that we developed to contribute to building the data refuge.
And this is all public data, so the citizens of the U.S. have a right to it. It belongs to us as citizens of the U.S. Did you ever hear about any kind of pushback that you got from any government agencies?
We got a lot of positive feedback from federal scientists. I mean, people were really excited to participate. We had federal workers come help at some data rescue events, sometimes off the record. We had people reach out to us and say privately, this is data I'm concerned about, please get it. So we had a lot of really positive feedback. We had the concerns that people brought up were often just about actually wanting us to help them rather than see them as adversaries. So right. that basically a lot of them said, like, we're already actually doing a really good job backing up our data, and what we need are advocates in other ways. Or in some cases they would say, you know, our website can only handle so much traffic. If you're trying to get a whole, you know, room full of people to download data from our website all at once, you might crash it. Can you just give us a heads up?
Right.
So that we can make sure that we have the, you know, infrastructure in place to support this, or like, just ask us for the data. We might send it to you. You don't need to go hacking for it. And all of those, I mean, we got every range of comment. We got people who were absolutely grateful, who came, you know, behind the scenes and said, here's exactly the code that you need to use to get data. And then we got people who said, you know, actually, we've got this. It was a really broad range, but largely and overwhelmingly positive and supportive from everyone all the way through the government that we talked to.
Good. That's good to hear. So the next sort of phase now is the Data Refuge is doing data stories. Can you talk about what that is?
Yeah. So the way that I think of it is we learned through the project so many ways that environmental and climate data and really all federal data is vulnerable. But one of the biggest and most overwhelming ways that it's vulnerable is simply that people don't know how valuable it is. That people don't know how much of their world is aided by federal environmental and climate data or by federal data. And so what the folks at PPEH are doing, and again, the library is a big supporter of this, but I'm less involved in this project than I was earlier and then I will be in other kinds of data refuge projects. But basically what this project is doing is trying to call attention to the ways that data impacts people's lives, the ways that people rely on it, who cares about it and why. And ultimately, I think the more we dove into the technology, I was so deep in the weeds of exactly how we should be getting data and under what circumstances and what constitutes an appropriate data package and what a data sheet should look like and what the metadata should look like. But really, the further deeply in you go, the more you can see that the work that most needs doing is advocacy work, is people just understanding how much environmental and climate data the federal government produces and how much we need. And just data in general, like the importance of the U.S. Census for all kinds of parts of life that I think we don't recognize and how valuable it is internationally. I mean, I think, as I said, the more we got into the weeds of this project, the more it was clear and the more we could see that the most valuable work, the work that most needs doing is storytelling about this data so that more people care.
Yeah, everybody's focusing on, as far as the census goes, people are focusing on that citizenship question thing. But I think I had heard before that even that people were concerned that the Census Department is not staffed up enough to actually do maybe a good job of that. And how important that is, because, I mean, it's obviously, I mean, constitutionally mandated, but I mean, every 10 years, and it only happens every 10 years. So if you mess it up once, it doesn't come back around for another 10 years. And you've got this big gap in data. It's sort of like when you're doing genealogy records, there's like this one year that records got burned or something, so you like 1890 or whatever, there's nothing because it's all gone,
right?
You just hate to see a gap like that.
The number of federal programs that that rely on accurate census data or huge ranges of data, the reason that they're collected is so that the government could figure out, for instance, where to put resources, right? Where should we how much money does each community get is based on census information. Representation is based on, how many people are represented by each representative in the House of Representatives is by the census. Right. That's for the census. But for each of these, small data sets and big ones, what are the satellites doing? Who needs them and who uses them? Is it worth, having a satellite program that where we have public satellite image? Like who needs that? Those kinds of questions, because most people in their day-to-day lives, like, don't imagine that air quality data affects their life. But when you look at the ways that, funding for asthma prevention and that sort of thing are tied to these things, or just all sorts of ways that the government impacts our lives, through city, state, federal, but also just private sector uses of this information and use by scientists and academics. Like, it's just everywhere. And so I think, the story, data storytelling is just trying to come up with as many examples of ways that data is useful. And I don't want to talk about their project. I think it's most useful to talk to them about it, but I really love it. I think it's super important. And I'm thrilled that they're doing it. And we're helping. I mean, yes. We're ready too.
And the last thing I wanted to ask about was, so what is your future involvement with Data Refuge going to be? What kind of projects are you looking forward to working with?
My experience spending this really intensive sort of 6 months just deeply diving into the world of federal information, it just changed the way that I think about libraries and the way that I think about the role that we have in the sort of information landscape. So a lot of the past, 9 months or so since the Data Refuge work slowed down a bit, at least on my end, has been trying to incorporate some of what I learned in that kind of crazy time into the work that we're doing. And so some things are like less exciting to talk about because it's really just changing the way that we work. But a few that are more specific are one that there's this open data community, this civic technology world that all these people who are pushing for public access to information, who don't see themselves connected to libraries, the civic tech, Code for America type folks, of which there are so many, and they're doing such great work, and they are really missing so much that libraries could do to offer to help them, because our communities just aren't great at talking to one another. And so that's one thing that I'm going to continue to work on, is how can the library community and the civic tech community become better friends. More directly, I'm hiring very soon a public and community data curation fellow for the libraries, a postdoctoral fellow for the next 2 years. And one of the things that I'm really hopeful that person will work on is building collaboration in Pennsylvania specifically, with other libraries in Pennsylvania and the state of Pennsylvania, ideally, to maybe model a little bit of the kinds of supportive networks that I think we can create between libraries and government data producers to produce better data that is more broadly useful for the kind of for extra purposes and safer in multiple locations. And so this problem that we addressed in Data Refuge, which was huge and federal and everything, I'd really like to take a little slice of that and just look at state produced data for Pennsylvania and what libraries in Pennsylvania can do directly to work with the state to produce data that we can hold and save for the future, and make available more widely, and see if we can get a little pilot going in Pennsylvania.
The Big Data Refuge project was a national thing, but it can obviously be done at a local level pretty easily too. So,
exactly. And I want to, and so many people were, in the project were like, what can we do to help? And my answer was always sort of talk, go local if you can. And local meaning look at the things that your community needs, whether, what data does your community rely on, and then try to get that data, try to work with the producers of that data to see how you can help safeguard it, keep a copy, whatever, we just need way more experiments in this area. And so I'm trying to sort of walk the walk and see if I can come up with an experiment that is a little bit more scalable for my organization.
Well, Laurie, thank you so much for being on the show today. If people wanted to follow up and learn more about your work, how could they get in touch with you?
Well, I'm on Twitter at LiberLaurie. There's a lot of Laurie librarians out there, but I'm LiberLaurie. And I guess folks can email me, laallen@upenn.edu.
All right. Well, thank you for such your great work. Where you, I guess you single-handedly saved the government. So thank you for that. All right. Thank you, Laurie.
Thank you so much.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta. Views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of my place of work or the place of work of guests. For past interviews, visit circulatingideas.com and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. And help others find the show by leaving a rating or review. You can follow the show on Twitter @CircIdeas or like the show's Facebook page. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating your ideas.
I think I'm probably altogether an editing nightmare, but I'll do what I can.
Thanks again to our sponsor, Unique Management Services, offering inbound phone and chat coverage to help libraries deliver outstanding virtual service to patrons. Unique Patron Service Solutions, virtual service solved. Visit uniquelibrary.com to learn more and schedule your free demo. That's uniquelibrary.com.